All right, well, maybe I'll go ahead and start.
My name is Stephen Holtz. Teach history at Kenyon College in Ohio, primarily African history, also international studies. But what I've been doing this week at Holden is talking about, well, religious diversity in the Maghreb.
Thank you.
Maghreb meaning, here's my map, meaning the area, western part of North Africa, which in sort of the early Muslim Arab world was referred to as the West. It was the western extent, the western edge of the Muslim world, the Maghreb, the West. And so what we have here is, in modern day terms, it's the countries of Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia. But most of the people were living in this area, so another way to think of it is basically the Atlas Mountains, and it's in the coastal plain, you know, on the Mediterranean Sea. So that's the Maghreb, the western North Africa. And the basic question or issue that I've been considering is the special case of the Maghreb. And actually it happens in other parts of the Muslim world. As you get further from Mecca and Medina, further from Saudi Arabia, Islam comes into closer contact with other religious traditions. I think the further you get sort of from the capital or the heartland of Islam, there's more adaptation to local religions, local beliefs, and a little bit more, you know, sort of a necessity in the part of Islam to adapt to different traditions. And so I find the same thing in the Maghreb, and I guess the interesting part about this is, for me, it sort of challenges the common perception today that there's this sort of intractable war between Islam and the West, in Christianity or Islam in Europe, or Western civilization.
Nice tie-dye for me.
Is that in the Maghreb, you actually do have a long history of peaceful coexistence. That there's many instances in the Maghreb of Judaism. Well, first, sort of early religious traditions of the Berber peoples, who are the indigenous peoples in this area, as well as Judaism, Christianity, all sort of blending in some respects in the Maghreb and sort of living side by side. Now, there's also been tensions in that history, moments, to a certain extent, some exclusion and separation and segregation. But it seems to me that there's this recurring potential, at least, for peaceful coexistence and mutual influence on one another. So early in the week, I looked at Judaism, Christianity, and then yesterday we discussed the film of Gods and Men, which is depicting an episode in the 1990s with French Christian monks in the Atlas Mountains. So today, to conclude, in some ways, this is perhaps the most, is the clearest example of this mutual influence, and that's in the case of Sufism. How Sufism is sort of the mystical form of Islam, and how within sort of the Sufi tradition or Sufi expressions of Islam, it seems to me you have quite a bit of room for or interaction with and mutual influence with Judaism, Christianity, and with Berber religions. And so, and you'll find that Sufism has become the dominant, historically is the dominant form of Islam in the Maghreb. So it seems to me that this, perhaps more than anything, helps to explain or helps to illustrate the religious pluralism in the Maghreb, is the dominant role of Sufism, and it's sort of the malleability, if you will, of Islam with it as Sufism. So I don't know if some of you are already familiar with Sufism or what it means. I mean, I think most people are,
quick question.
Sure.
When you say Maghreb, you mean exactly?
Western North Africa. Maghreb is basically the Arabic term.
Not just city center, but like that whole region.
Yeah, the whole region. I'm talking about Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia, but basically the Atlas Mountains and this area here is where most of the people live. So I won't talk much about the Tuareg and the Sahara. So Sufism. Right, Sufi, I mean, comes from Tawassuf. It's an Arabic term for sort of the people who wear wool. So it isn't really a formal religious tradition. I think that those people who are Sufi don't even self-identify as Sufi necessarily unless they're talking to an English speaker. In their mind, they're just sort of a purer form of Islam or a more spiritual. I don't know. That doesn't really mean anything. But basically, I think the best way to think of it is mysticism, which is, I think, in every religious tradition, it's practitioners or adherents of the religion who value more than anything the experience of the divine, the experience of God, as an emotional experience, as developing a personal connection with the divine, as being more important than sort of the written word, more important than sort of institutional dogmas and rules, the sense that, you know, the sort of the purest sort of faith and the and purest understanding of God is that which is achieved wordlessly, and that it's something you feel and you experience. This is mysticism. And so how do you achieve that sense of union with God? How do you achieve this sense of a personal connection with God? In most mystical traditions, probably the leading way is through self-denial, a way to kind of to discipline yourself, to try and overcome your you know, obsession with your own thoughts, with your own physical needs, with your own personal, you know, surroundings, your duties, all your kind of worldly concerns. And so monasticism is a common way to sort of pursue this mystical path, to withdraw from society out into a secluded area, and so you can just kind of focus on your own thoughts, focus on developing this relationship with God. Another common practice in Sufism is in other mystical traditions is sort of asceticism, to fast regularly, to have repetitive prayers. I mean, that's a common thing as well, just kind of in the Christian mystical tradition, you know, monastic chanting. It's like the more, if you're chanting for hours on end, after a while you kind of lose yourself in the music and begin to, you know, just kind of focus on the presence of God. And so Sufism has a similar thing, and different sort of versions of Sufism have different repetitive practices. Sometimes it's musical, but there's also some that are dancing. I mean, I think one of the more sort of visible Sufi groups is the so-called whirling dervishes in Turkey. I mean, their dhikr, their repetitive practice, their discipline is this dance where they're, you know, I can't remember how, every gesture means something, because they're pointing to the center of the earth and they're pointing to God, and then their head is faced a certain way, and they've got this kind of dress thing going on, and they're kind of whirling around. But the whole ceremony is just loaded with symbolic meaning. But so for them, they're trying to lose themselves in this dance. They're trying to sort of forget themselves and thereby make room and, you know, for God. So that's Sufism, in a word. And it's been around in Islam since about 900 or so, when some, you know, Muslims began to embrace this. And of course, there's a question of where did it arise from? Was it influenced by Christian monasticism or Jewish monasticism? And certainly probably had an influence. But then it developed into its own tradition, and then in different local expressions of this. And so what I'm going to focus on really is, what form does Sufism take within in Morocco, Algeria, and Tunisia? And how does it sort of overlap with Jewish and Christian traditions and sort of, you know, embrace and incorporate them? So starting off, you can see that already. There's someone else coming to need a handout.
Thank you very much.
Sure. So I'm going to talk about several things. One of this image here, this picture, is of a sort of classic Maghrebian or what you'll find in Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia. This is actually a detail from a water fountain, a public water fountain. And you can just see this, it's a mosaic design. And I'll say a little bit more about how I would argue this, which is sort of a common motif in mosaic work throughout the Maghreb, and actually even also in the Arab world, has some of its roots in Sufi teachings. It's the mathematics of it, it's a way of worshiping God through math. It has to do with an eight-pointed star with circles, basically squares superimposed on squares, and I'll show you some geometric drawings that illustrate that. So it's a way that, you know, a Sufi, sort of a devout Sufi who knows the math, would look at this and say, oh, that's an expression of the divine there, this kind of unity of God. And then I give you a couple of quotes here from the Quran to illustrate some of this as well, that God is above all, that God is one, and that God is benevolent, from the Quran. And then a poem from Ibn al-Arabi, who is a noted philosopher, poet, Sufi scholar, who lived primarily in Spain and Morocco, but also was very influential in the region and even the wider Muslim world. And I think it illustrates a kind of a central tenet of Sufism, that it feels that it embraces all sort of understandings of the monotheistic God, of the same God as of Judaism, Christianity. My heart has become able to take on all forms, is a pasture for gazelles, and for monks an abbey. It is a temple for idols, and the pilgrims Kaaba, the Kaaba being the black stone and the square in Mecca where pilgrimages are made. It is the tablets of the Torah and also the pages of the Quran. I believe in the religion of love. Whatever directions his caravans may take, love is my religion and my faith. So this is a Muslim scholar who's sort of advocating this much more expansive, broader understanding of Islam and of worshiping God in general. I guess I already talked about him. So, to kind of give this overview of some points I want to raise. So the development of Sufism in the Maghreb starts out, I think, sort of what influences early formation in the Maghreb is this need to reconcile different religious traditions, because the people living in the Maghreb as Arab conquests come through are primarily had been Christian, and before that sort of Berber indigenous beliefs. And I think that's one reason Sufism attracts interest and is somewhat popular is because it, in a way, allows a smoother transition, if you will, to converting to Islam. If you can continue to practice certain beliefs, if it's not so much about doing exactly this or doing exactly that or listening to the set of rules delivered from these Arab conquerors, if being Muslim means sort of experiencing God and there's all kinds of ways to experience God, it allows a little more variation. It allows for kind of a more gradual assimilation of the existing religious beliefs into this, into this new dominant religion. And so that's one reason this happens. And you'll find that Sufism throughout the Muslim world is most prevalent along the edges, whether it's in the Maghreb or in Turkey or in Indonesia or in sub-Saharan West Africa. Sufism is the dominant sort of form of Islam because it is a little bit less legalistic, you could say, a little bit less concerned about, following the rules, a specific set of rules. So one of the more prominent of these Sufi philosophers, poets, is Ibn al-Arabi. He lives, from 1165 to 1240. Born and raised in Spain, or at the time they called it Andalusia, which is the sort of the Muslim-ruled Spain. Southern half of Spain was under Muslim rule for about 700 years. So it was and sort of united with Morocco as a single cultural sphere. He's born and raised in Andalusia, but then travels, lives, and works throughout the Arab world, but primarily in Spain and Morocco, and then spends some time studying and teaching in Egypt and Syria and so on. But what I find, one of the things, if you read his books, this is one of his poems here, where he sort of is talking about the wide umbrella of what Sufism and Islam, in his opinion, should embraces Judaism and Christianity. Here's the math thing I was talking about, which I think is another illustration of Sufism. This is Ibn al-Arabi was trying to explain Sufism, and he uses geometry to talk about the unity of God, that nature, as he and sort of the mathematical understandings of the universe, squares and circles. I'm afraid I don't understand all of them. It starts out with sort of the cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west. Then he sort of correlates that with different characteristics of the divine, and how they sort of intersect with one another and then are unified. So then you take this and then you sort of elaborate it a little more and make more sort of circles in this endless pattern. God becomes infinite. You can spread this mosaic out into infinity. But how it's all connected. That's the idea that that all of creation is integrated together and is sort of suffused with this divine spirit and with this order that God is in control. And so that's sort of the geometry of this eight-pointed star, then for Sufis is sort of an emblem of this unity and order in creation. And then this then gets translated into this kind of style of mosaics. And this is a common theme, especially just this eight-pointed star. At the center of each one of these things, you're going to find a little centerpiece that's an eight-pointed star. A square superimposed on another square. But then once you expand its scale, and it kind of melts into circles. And not being a mathematician, I can't explain it.
So, with that, do they see instead of God being out there, that God is within us, and that they would say, God is within me, and God is within you, and we're connected through God that way, or
no, it's more like God is out there.
God's out there.
Yeah, yeah, okay. And it's more a sense of trying to get in touch with God, and
okay.
The less you think about yourself, the more receptive you are to divine influence of God. Yeah.
It almost sounds like the inspiration for this understanding is the natural world, though. The symmetry in the natural world, is that what you're saying?
Well,
he's saying that it's directions, east, west, north, south, and then the kind of symmetry is what it's like.
Might be natural. Well, yeah, I guess that's a question. I don't know.
Reflects.
Actually, some of Ibn al-Arabi, I mean, some of this is from Greek geometry, too. I think some of these ideas arose from these Greek, thicker, back, B.C. era.
Oh, so it's just continuity from that time?
I think some of these ideas, but he's trying to give sort of a monotheistic stamp to geometry, if you will. But that's a good question. I don't know if they looked to nature to create these models so much as they did. I mean, some of it gets into medieval Europe, too, this idea that, the stars, the planets must be circling in a perfect circle because God wouldn't make an oval. that God likes circles and squares. I think this was a common way to kind of think of geometry, that it was, so it was very troubling later when they finally realized that there was these elliptical orbits going on and that not all, because they saw this perfect circular moons.
I guess the question is, did they start with the abstract geometry? Is it abstract if they start from an observation? Then work into these principles.
I think it was more from the abstract, if it makes sense. But still, I mean, when the people came up with circles, they were looking at the moon. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, when they got telescopes and saw the craters, then it kind of changes that.
I guess
that's a good question.
But the abstract perfect form is a circle.
Right.
So how did they come up with the idea of interconnectedness, of everything that's connected?
Well, I think it's just an old religious idea, yeah. I mean, that's a good question. I don't know if there's Persian influence going on here on Islam. I mean, because the first Sufism really gets started among Persian Muslims in Iran, and they're the ones who first kind of put it into writing and talk about it. And so maybe there's some Eastern philosophy.
Okay.
But that's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. About this kind of universality of God.
Right.
Which is, it's an interesting contrast with, I don't know if you've been attending Fred Niener's Bible studies. He's talking about how the sort of Jewish understanding of God, how it starts out as a really small local and gets gradually bigger and bigger. So I think by the time Islam is around, there's already this sense that God is universal.
Actually, a little off the track, but back to the poem. The term Kaaba means what?
Kaaba.
Pilgrim's Kaaba.
Yeah, Kaaba is, in Mecca, you have this big sort of cube-shaped structure, and in the corner of that structure is this shiny black volcanic stone. And the Kaaba, I guess you can refer either to the black stone or to the cube-shaped building that it's stuck in. And it's all covered with tapestries and stuff. So the Kaaba basically refers to the site, this building that that all Muslims are expected to make a pilgrimage to.
So it's a pilgrimage to Mecca.
Yeah.
And that's where Muhammad supposedly went off. That's where the Kaaba is, right?
Right. Well, yeah, and that's another whole topic.
That's a whole different thing.
How much Islam incorporated, because the black shiny stone was sacred before Muhammad came on the scene.
Oh.
So that it's a little complicated about how Islam, even in its origin, sort of co-opted, sort of pre-Islamic Arab religion. In order to complicate this further, I'm afraid. Earlier this week, I showed this picture of a Byzantine baptismal font, which makes raises the question. And I realized, wait a second. So maybe this kind of interest in circles and squares and stuff, predates Islam, and it's, I think, it's sort of a Greco-Roman fascination with that shape. Because here you have this Byzantine church in Tunisia, and they made this baptismal font with circles, and it's all made out of mosaic tiles, and so it's, so in my opinion, maybe just making this up, but again, for me, it raises the possibility that this is sort of a Maghrebian culture, that this fascination with mosaics, with fascination with circles and squares and groups of eight, and that this Byzantine church, they felt the need to make their baptismal font like that, long before Islam came into the scene. So that's some, sort of artistic level. Another aspect of, or any other questions or comments about that for you? So in my, as a historian, I'm always looking at social structures and stuff. For me, one of the more interesting aspects of this is the Zawiyas. This is I should, just to reiterate, I don't know if I mentioned this, I mean, most of what these pictures are taken from and most of my interest in this is based on the last summer I was had the good fortune to be part of this Fulbright sponsored sort of study seminar tour with about a dozen other faculty from the U.S. and we spent about half the summer in Morocco and Tunisia exploring this question of religious diversity. So that's why I'm doing this, these sessions. So yeah, this was, we spent a few days up in the Ahansal Valley in the High Atlas Mountains visiting this Zawiya, which sort of had acquired some fame because an anthropologist, Ernest Gellner, had spent some time there. It was the first sort of Western scholar to write in detail about what, you know, what Sufism was like in these rural areas. And so he spent his time here. Actually, so this is the, you know, one of these villages in the valley. And this is the, actually it used to be a fortified granary, like the community would store their grain there as kind of a, you know, a common supply and protection against marauders. But then these things get, some of them got converted into the zawiyas. And here's a mosque just next door to it. So what were these zawiyas? Well, what happened is, and here you can kind of make connections to Holden Village. Imagine, if you will, the Holden Village, say 300 years from now, you know, population density keeps on going up. Let's say people move into the nearby valleys or up and down the road, creek, you have shepherds setting up shop or villages open up. You know, if Holden Village suddenly becomes the site of it's kind of regarded as sacred space, if the people living in nearby valleys come to Holden seeking guidance, spiritual comfort, come for the Holden Vespers, but also come to use the post office and to buy things coming up lake. Since, you know, Zawiyas sort of served that same purpose. You had these sort of men, mostly men, but sometimes women, who due to their sort of piety, their holy way of life, would come to be respected in these villages. They had a better knowledge of the Quran, of Islamic teachings, and so then people would come to them and ask them for advice, spiritual advice, but also practical advice, because of their literacy, and they also would sort of serve as sort of conduits or mediators to the wider Islamic world, the sense that, you know, what form Islam takes here, these guys are never going to, you know, these farmers and herders are never going to make it on the pilgrimage. They may never even get down to see the big cities. So for them, the sort of personification of Islam and what Islam means is how it's embodied in the life of the local imam or the local sheikh, the local holy man. And so what happens is the way role that Sufism plays in these communities is Islam, is in the lives and work and leadership of these men and women, these holy men. So what happens is first they just start out in their own homes. Well, then, you know, due to people coming to visit them, then they create sort of a lodge system. They, you know, create housing for visitors and pilgrims to come. And then soon, let's say that guy dies, then somebody else takes his place, and you might make a shrine to somebody who died 100 years ago. It's like over time they're sort of revered, and their legend expands to fill this up. So really what happens is that it's, you know, Islam is influenced by rural Berber culture to take on this form of Sufism. Sufism makes sense, where it's sort of this, you know, focusing on the holiness of this person rather than thinking of Islam as this world religion. It's thought of as the religion of particular sacred spaces in these villages, and as the practices and sort of the leadership of these holy men. So the Zawiya is just the name for the school or the institution that serves as sort of the heart, the representative or the example of Islam in these rural communities. So what happens over time, though, is these Zawiyas then do acquire reputations in the cities, where they think, you know, that as people in the cities, you know, you leave Holden, go down, and you continue to think of Holden as a holy place. You know, you think of it as it's apart from the sins of the world. It's up here in kind of an idyllic setting. And the similar thing happens in the cities. They'll come out to visit these Zawiyas, and they'll to visit these holy men living out in these rural areas. What happens then, these sort of Zawiyas pop up in the cities then, sort of, if you will, branch offices of these rural-based Zawiyas. And the only thing that comes to mind, I don't know if anyone lives in Minneapolis, I think like St. Martin's Table or other places where sort of, I don't know, sort of Holdenites make a little, you know, community down in some major city, start a coffee shop, a bookstore, whatever, and try to practice the same values and beliefs and sort of and ministry that Holden practices up in the mountains. So then you have these Zawiyas start, and then it rapidly becomes institutionalized, so you have these pretty big, powerful, wealthy Zawiyas in the cities. And all this takes several centuries to proceed. But it really has its birth, its genesis in these rural Berber communities. This kind of more open sense of Islam, but peasant level, if you will, not scholars. So here's some more pictures of this to illustrate this. And this is in Saleh, which is a big city at one time in Morocco. Shows you a little more ornate. This is the prayer hall. All this, really carved plaster and mosaics. The dormitory rooms, the idea is that now they attract students, so students come and study at these Saleh's. And then they continue to serve as sort of centers of Islam. So then, I thought this was interesting. Now, all the Zawiyas then in the cities have green roofs. I thought this was interesting.
Oh my gosh.
McDonald's and Fez sort of co-op. It's a little sacrilegious because like all the Zawiyas in the cities of Morocco and Algeria and Tunis have green tile roofs, and it sort of marks them out as religious institutions. And McDonald's thought, oh yeah, let's get a green roof. It'd be kind of like a McDonald's in the U.S. having stained glass windows. You know, it's not overtly sacrilegious, but you walk in and you kind of feel like it's a sacred space somehow if it's got stained glass. I thought it was a little absurd. come to McDonald's and learn about Sufism. All right, so that's Zawiyah. Then I guess to finish with Zawiyah, then you do have the development of Sufi orders. I mean, again, this is talking about centuries. At some of these Zawiyahs, if some old, holy man sort of figures it out that, okay, what for our religious exercise, like the whirling dervishes have their circular dance, within Morocco, more often, it would be some kind of specific kind of chant or song that would be associated with that Sufi order, basically it's like a monastic order. Like they do things a certain way, they have a certain daily routine that they feel is more God-pleasing. And so this also develops as you have Sufi orders, and it's one fundamental part of this is this idea, and then you get this kind of apostolic succession kind of idea where the founder appoints somebody to take his place, and then they appoint somebody to take their place, and they kind of have this chain of authority, like who has this kind of in with God. So that's the kind of internal tensions, I would say, with Sufism, is while it may have this kind of wide-open mystical beliefs as its foundation, in practice, as happens anywhere in the world with a religion, I would say, anytime someone sees this as a valuable commodity something that people are interested in, then inevitably gets institutionalized. So that's what happens with Sufism throughout the world, is that you do develop these very distinct orders or schools of thought with Sufism. Any questions about Sufi orders or Zawiyahs? I'm going to move to a different aspect of Sufism, and this is the way I'm kind of just saying more of the same thing. And I realize finally with my sessions I have a way to conclude the theme for the summer. There's a sacred spring. And this, I think, this one site, I realize, is a good representation of how so different religious traditions in the Maghreb kind of intertwine and overlap and build on each other. So this is at Chella, just outside of Rabat. It's an ancient site. They found ruins, I think even going back to the Carthaginians here. It's right on the edge of this river, going into the ocean. It seemed like a great spot. One reason it's been a good spot for settlement is there's a spring. There's this perennial spring that comes burbling out of the rocks there, the limestone. And so they found evidence that people have used this water for a long time. And so here, what you have is the remains of sort of a shrine at the top of these steps over here is kind of a shrine to this spring. So very sort of, not just pre-Islamic, but pre-Christian, pre-anything, this idea of nature worship, going back to your point, that nature is the center of this, this site. So again, you've got steps down in there, so you can take a cool bath in this cold water. I'm not sure if people are supposed to go into these chambers or not, maybe. That makes sense. And then the water itself then is led out through a channel where it irrigates a wonderful Andalusian garden, like a Spanish-style garden with fruit trees, citrus trees, and all kinds of flowers and things. So you know, kind of visible, tangible, you know, evidence of the where the river flows life above. Well, what you have at Chella then is when the Romans show up, then they build their a town there. And that's what you have here is the ruins of the sort of the market area of the Roman town. But at the same time, you have actually the spring is right down in these trees down in there. Then you have these are the shrines of the tombs of saints, and this is another characteristic of Sufism. Some would argue is the most important thing is these holy men, people who are during their life are considered particularly pious, particularly saintly. I mean, you know, just kind of very generous, very sort of devout, and people sort of regard them as having some special connection with God. Well, after death, then they would be buried and then venerated on these shrines. And so sainthood, now where does this come from? Is this, you know, some people say, oh, they got it from the Catholics, but that doesn't make sense at all because it predates, you know, a lot of that and kind of developed separately. And I would argue might have, you know, its roots in Berber religion. But you won't find this in Saudi Arabia. I mean, in sort of the heartland of Islam, they would regard this as very heretical or unorthodox to be worshiping these holy people. You know, they would say, no, you know, God, you should be worshiping God alone. So it's interesting that this also comes within under Sufism, is this kind of idea of saintly people who then acquire following, and people make pilgrimages to these tombs. So these are old tombs. And then in the same site, then here's the walls of a zawiya. So that was constructed right next to the spring as well. And that's what then you see in this other picture. The same site, and it shows you the ruins of a zawiya there. I don't know if you noticed before. Now the storks have set up a shop. Actually, I'll show you the previous picture there, too. You can see the stork nests. So that's the, I guess maybe the most interesting thing about the site now is you have to watch where you're walking. Stork poop coming down. So here's the minaret from the old, like, 12th century zawiya, 13th century, now the home of storks. And yeah, and all of this now is just sort of a museum. I mean, it's not actively used as a mosque or a zawiya anymore. But so it's the remains of this old mosaic work and whatnot. But I just thought it was fascinating to show you in one sort of site how you have these layers of religious tradition that have all kind of built on each other. And I would say all sort of acceptable within Sufism, you know, respecting the spirit of God wherever it might manifest itself. All right, well, I'm going to show you two other aspects of this with some videos of Sufism, and that's in two different sort of Sufi orders to kind of demonstrate. I should have set this up. This is going to take me a little while. One is this tradition called Ganawa. G-N-A-W-A, which you find in Morocco, but there's another version of it in Tunisia called Stambele. And as an African historian or historian of Africa, I find it particularly interesting because this shows you how sort of sub-Saharan African culture has also, and religious beliefs have been incorporated into sort of Moroccan and Maghrebian Islam. So it's not just they're incorporating Judaism, Christianity, Berber religions, but also sub-Saharan African religions. Because there's been a long history of interaction across the Sahara Desert with sub-Saharan Africans either coming, you know, as merchants to trade or via Berbers and Tuareg merchants across the desert, or, you know, admittedly, it's, you know, for long periods as slaves, many of them, but also musicians, were, you know, playing in the courts of the rulers in North Africa. So one thing that's happened then is this influence in some Sufi orders in southern Morocco, what they got from this in the Ganawa Sufi orders. Ganawa is sort of from the Berber word for blacks or sub-Saharan Africans. It's the same root as Guinea, if you think of Guinea-Bissau or Guinea, other countries in that part of Africa. So one part of this is this basically what the Sufi orders get from sub-Saharan Africans. One thing is for their dhikr, for their spiritual exercise, is a kind of dance where they're swirling their head around and twirling something on the top of their head. And also the music. And this is what's, I think, fascinating and has correlations with the United States, is one is this instrument called the djimbri. It's pronounced different ways, but it's basically It's like a bass guitar, is what it sounds like. I mean, the riff for the Ganao music, it's, you know, is like, is basically what Ganao is, sort of the Moroccan version, if you will, of gospel and blues in the United States. Just as African American musical influences and religious sensibilities, you know, served as the foundation for gospel and blues, you find that the same culture in West Africa gave rise to sort of Ganao music among the Sufi orders. So, if you will, you know, so there are some Sufi orders in southern Morocco. When they do their chanting of music, it's like, wait a second, this sounds like, you know, Mississippi Delta blues, because it's a similar kind of bass, you know, it's like going on. And then the other thing distinctive about it is the castanets. There's these metal castanets, and I could do a whole thing on this. Just the, but the rhythms are very distinctively West African. So I'm going to show you. It's not the best video of it. There's other better ones. I don't think I can get Wi-Fi in here. Yeah, so because there's some all kinds of wonderful YouTube ones, but if you give me a few minutes here, I think I've got it. Where did I put it? Never mind. Let's see if I can act. There we go. Oh, this is a Ganao video. Oh, hold on a second. Sorry, I didn't set up my speakers. Have any of you been to Morocco?
Yes.
Okay, did you go to Marrakesh? And
I did, I went to Marrakesh in Tangier.
And were you harassed by Ganawa the musicians? Guys with the little head things and trying to get you to take their picture.
I remember hearing some more like modern, got a tape of modern Moroccan music.
Oh, okay.
So it definitely had a, you could tell there was an Arabic world culture kind of sound to it.
Right.
So it sounded similar to some Egyptian music I heard.
Oh, okay.
Or some stuff that actually froze.
Yeah. Because what's happened with Ganawa is, just as, you know, sort of fairly British rock musicians during the late 60s, early 70s got interested in Indian music, and so all of a sudden the sitar pops up in the Beatles songs and whatnot. But at the same time, like Led Zeppelin spends several months, and Rolling Stones spend several months in southern Morocco, and there's several songs and albums that influence, that reflect the tradition. So now what's happened is Ganawa music has become, you know, it's changed into basically, you know, it's been highly commercialized, and they've realized, hey, these Westerners think this is cool, let's, you know, adapt it to Western tourist ears. So it's changed a bit. That's a little better. I think I can make this bigger. Yeah. Yeah. Or not. What just happened? Sorry?
Is it plugged in?
Oh, you're right. I have the USB port. Thank you. Give the computer a moment to recognize. This was a performance these guys gave to our group in the atrium of this kind of villa area. But it was all echoey, so all you hear is the castanets. but this is the djembri, the kind of the, some call it a precursor to the banjo or to bass guitar. But it's sort of doing this bass line underneath there. And the castanets, I was going to bring along a pair of them to demonstrate, but part of my journey, I flew, and it's like, okay, I'm already near the luggage limit, so I didn't want to weigh it down with cast iron things. But it's interesting because they're going kind of a 2-2 time on one hand and a 3-3 time on the other. And then here you see more of the mosaic I was talking about. And then the other thing that's West African about it is cowrie shells are part of it. Cowrie shells, which are a form of currency in West Africa, also are sort of part of that influence. So yeah, so what this is meant to illustrate, Ganawa music, G-N-A-W-A, is again how at least Sufi orders in southern Morocco over the centuries incorporated West African music and some West African religious beliefs. The other, this particular song they're doing was part of a Sufi ceremony where they would play this kind of music all night long with the idea of inducing a trance. The idea is that if you kind of fall in this trance, then your body becomes completely susceptible to possession by spirits. And the question is, okay, was this, you know, the Holy Spirit, was this divine spirits, or was this spirits of the ancestors? And you kind of got this gray area here with a West African religious tradition that's talking about ancestral spirits that then possess the person who's sort of been made more susceptible to this by dancing all night long to this music. But obviously, Muslims would not want to be possessed by ancestral spirits. But still, they would incorporate the music and the dancing and the repetitive rhythm, to try and get the same for the same idea of a spiritual experience. So anyways, I think that's kind of an interesting aspect of that. Okay. Oh, that's the end of those pictures. Then I'm going to show you one other example of Sufism today. I mean, Ganawa sort of tradition is pretty old in Morocco. Something that just has shown up during the 20th century is Bouchachia. Berber term, I'm not sure what it means. Bouchachia basically, well, it's a splinter group from another Sufi order, which is in turn a splinter group from another Sufi order. So it has a kind of a long sort of genealogy, if you will. But what it has become in Morocco, and this is interesting, distinct about Morocco, and people wonder with this whole Arab Spring, or even with these Islamist insurrection groups that that we found in Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and the Taliban in Afghanistan. How has Morocco managed to avoid that? How is it that, for the most part, they've been able to escape either Islamist, insurrectionists, as well as sort of democratic, upheaval? Well, one way to explain it is their embrace of Sufism as sort of Moroccan-style Islam, because Sufism then is a lot more, is less legalistic, less strict, you could say, a little bit more assimilative. And so what the Moroccan government does is says, well, okay, our brand of Islam is Sufism, and it's Sufis are not violent, Sufis are more spiritual, if you will. And so in a way to kind of embrace this and promote Sufism is the Bouchachia order has sort of acquired some prominence, that the leader of the Bouchachia order is now a government minister, and he's working for the government as the head of sort of the Department of Religious Affairs. As well as they're getting funding now for schools that the Bouchachia order is running, so they're sort of have been sort of picked not just because they're Sufi, but also because they're Bouchachia. So while we were there, it was interesting that we were invited to visit a Bouchachia Zawiya and to observe one of the rituals, because it was pretty unusual. Because other Sufi orders are a little strict, a little bit more exclusive and guarded about that, but the Bouchachia, in order to show to Western tourists that not only are they open to sort of different religious traditions, but they're also open to Western secular influence, so yeah, come on in, walk, participate if you want. Women are all allowed. We're all together. So it's interesting how Bouchachia is sort of this, if you will, a modernized Sufism. It's seen as sort of more politically acceptable, less politically threatening, and therefore embraced by the Moroccan government. So I'm just going to show you a video of that ceremony. It's kind of like an invocation to their worship service. It's basically they're calling on God to come and bless their worship service.
They're much younger than the other musical groups.
So. Yeah, the other guys were actually professional musicians who had been...
I mean, because we know that there are so many people under the age of 25 in this whole area. I mean, there's youth and hopeless youth.
I think you're right. I think the Buchashia order is very deliberately targeting, if you will, or inviting young men to join the order, and young women. And we saw young women who were as well, just happened to see. And then, actually, this is one of the faculty members. She teaches in University of Cincinnati. So she was like just up there grooving. That's why. Yeah, we can hear that again. It's,
and those patterns on the wall are not eight-sided.
Yeah, I don't know. It's, I mean, you're right. Well, they got a circle going on, but it's, well, I don't know, 64-sided.
60.
Yeah, I don't know how to count up all the little leaves, but
it's
reminiscent. Anyway, but you're right, I guess.
But that brown, but in the middle is eight.
Oh,
you have that dark, that
this thing?
Between those two guys.
Oh.
See that division?
Mm-hmm.
Not the curtain, but way over here between.
Oh, over there, the more tiles,
you know.
Yeah, ceramic tiles. With more of that pattern. Oh, I can listen to it again. Sorry, this was taken with somebody else's digital still camera, and so it's sort of like. So again, you get a sense of Sufism. I think that's pretty common. This kind of repetitive chanting, sort of, if you will, the Islamic monastic tradition.
It's called Buddhashia.
Buddhashia. There's different ways to spell it. Unfortunately, there's no standard way. Hey, did I include a spelling on there?
Yeah. 3C.
Oh, okay. Right. Akadriya Buddhashia. So, all right. I don't know if there's questions or comments. I mean, I have suggested some of my own questions for discussion, but. Sufism.
Well, this is not, we don't interact with this as much as, say, the Islam in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Iraq. It seems pretty
innocuous or friendly.
Yeah, it's very different. It's not political. It doesn't feel political, but maybe that's not the whole story. Maybe there's political piece to this as well.
Well, it's more accepting. It's not blowing up things or whatever.
Right.
We don't hear about
them
as much.
Right, because I think it's the idea is that certainly they wouldn't regard Christians and Jews as the enemy, but rather as fellow worshippers of God. They look at
it's more inclusive.
Yeah. Right.
They wouldn't have a jihad.
Well, see, that's where it gets complicated. Historically, I think any religion, I would say, can get politicized. And even in Morocco, there was some jihad states that arose during the 1100s, 1200s, that were led by Sufi holy men. So even though, while you might be talking about mysticism and God loves everybody, but if that belief is seen as a way to muster forces and to... I mean, basically what happened there is they felt that the current rulers had become corrupt, had sort of strayed from Islam, strayed from sort of, the message. And so then Sufism then became sort of a rallying point as a way to kind of...
When we looked at Christian history, and we looked at the mystics, some mystics were burned as heretics.
Right.
In the sense of, but yet here on the side, it's not like, people are like, okay, you can do your thing, and that's cool, but then in Saudi Arabia, you have a much stricter version of Islam, so it's just kind of interesting to see how they can say, all right, you can do your thing, and that's fine, and you can do our thing, and that's okay, but never the two shall meet kind of thing. So I'm just kind of, how did that work? I mean, did they come to an understanding that don't come to my side and I won't come to your side? Or?
Well, yeah, basically. Yeah. I mean, I think, Wahhabis are, Wahhabism is the strict form that you find in Saudi Arabia today, which actually has, it's pretty shallow roots. It goes to the early 19th century. This idea that you have to wear certain clothes, you have to dress like Muhammad, you think Muhammad did, and that whole interpretation of Islam is a modern invention. You're right. The Moroccan government is very careful to not allow them in, but still there is some Saudi Arabian influence here. But I think the government is looking at it very closely because they don't want, sort of more violent, or extremist forms of Islam to crop up, because they would then become a challenge to the Moroccan government, which is fairly westernized, and even if it is a monarchy.
That makes sense.
So I think Morocco is very clearly positioning itself as sort of more of an open, inclusive Islam, but all, you know, and also close ties to the West and the Western culture. No, I think there are tensions between Saudi Arabia and other forms of Islam. I don't think Sufi scholars would necessarily be welcome in Saudi Arabia if they're going to preach this more inclusive thing. But it still happens. I mean, there's all kinds of synthesis and variation that takes place. You know, when pilgrims come to Mecca, I think everyone is included. You know, as long as they all embrace the basic tenets of Islam, I think there's all kinds of, you know, expressions of that or what that means.
Right. But there's an understanding of you kind of have to come to the table on this one, where there's things, but don't talk about these things while you're here.
Right. Or don't expect us to visit your saintly tombs. But that's a point I guess they make again and again. I think today the media, and sort of simplifying things and I think exacerbating tensions, tends to portray it as some kind of a war between Islam and Western civilization, when actually it's a war between a small number of extremist Muslims against their governments, who they feel are corrupt and unresponsive. What's happened is the U.S. has stepped into that war and is seen as siding with the corrupt government. So, I mean, basically, I mean, when, I don't know, this is public knowledge. Yeah, when I mean, it's all Saudi Arabians who did the violence in 9/11. Saudi Arabians who were mad at their government, at their monarchy for being corrupt, they felt sellouts to the United States, and so they're trying to get at their government trying to get the U.S. to stop supporting their government. So I think the vast majority of Muslims are sort of caught between those two and are moderate and have nothing against the United States or Western civilization or anything. So I think these extremists get all the press and attention because they're the ones carrying the guns and doing crazy things. In Morocco again and again, people are trying to say, no, we're the ones who stand for the true Islam, or, you know, the dominant or majority Muslim is, everyone's just trying to make a living and get along with each other, and not all dogmatic and suicidal.
They do have a close tie to the rest of Western Europe, right across. They can see Spain from Tangier.
Right. I mean, culturally, Morocco and Spain have... You know, Morocco has, people told me this in Tunisia and Morocco, they said and they're true, I mean, culturally, historically, geographically, they're closer and have more common with Spain and Italy than they do with Saudi Arabia.
And still some of the words, and, you know, ojalá, you know, I hope that, you know, ojalá que, you know, puede ir, you know, it's like, I hope that we can go somewhere. It's just using that phrase came from...
Okay, from the Berber era rule. Yeah, there's all kinds of things like in Spanish culture. Someone pointed out to me that a lot of the vocabulary with cattle ranching, I mean, like vaquero and you know, corral, lasso, while we think of them as Spanish words, actually they're Berber words. I mean, it was Berber cattle raisers, you know, Muslim Berbers who then became the main rulers class in Spain. They lent this practice and vocabulary to the Spanish and then bring it to North America. So it's African influence.
In the U.S., you don't hear much about the Sufi.
No, not a lot.
I was at a new mosque close to where I live in Seattle. A friend had invited me and just to see this building and how they did their thing. Mm-hmm. They had an art show and they happened to have a whirling dervish.
Oh, really?
And I said, well, now how does Sufi relate to... And there really wasn't much explanation. And that time, it's just kind of entertainment.
Oh, yeah, I think you're right.
I just don't care about it as much. I didn't know it really was a contemporary thing, and it is.
Oh, yeah,
It's not an ancient tradition. It has a contemporary manifestation, it sounds like.
Right, it's being reinvented. I mean, out of Turkey now, and this, they've got chapters all over, and some people are a little suspicious. It seems kind of cult-like, but it's the, what is it called? Not Guilin, it's Guilin. Well, there's this large group, it's, you know, kind of like the United Way, if you will, or Salvation Army of Turkey or something. But it's a Sufi group, a very modern Sufi group, and they've set up chapters all over the U.S. where they're trying to promote religious dialogue. But what makes people suspicious is that they're trying a little too hard to portray themselves as Western. Like, what are you trying to hide? I mean, the group in Columbus, stationed there, is called the Scioto River Association or something, named after the river in the town. But it is, they have an annual dinner where they invite all religious leaders in Columbus to come and they start off with an imam, a rabbi, a priest, a pastor, all do the invocation, if you will, a prayer to the beginning of the luncheon or whatever. So they're kind of promoting this cross-religious dialogue in the United States, and ultimately they're trying to promote the idea that Turkey is a more open Sufi Islam, and that America should not be afraid of Muslims, particularly not Turkish Muslims. Because Turkey is similarly like the Maghreb, is positioned, you know, in both, if you will, the Muslim and European worlds, and they see themselves as belonging to both, and that they're not, in their mind, it's not a contradiction, that it's perfectly normal to have both Western culture and Islam in the same society. And so that's so this happens in the United States as well. But sorry,
I have a question here. Should there be more dialogue between Christians and Sufi Muslims? And I think,
well, why not? Right. I don't know. Any thoughts about that? Would Christianity be threatened or watered down by Sufism? Or can there be one all-encompassing religion that encompasses both religions? I don't know.
What is
that heretical?
Any more of the spiritual or mystical sections of each religion might have more in common.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why I had the Ibn al-Arabi quote, because I think that's clear evidence that I think among both Christian and Muslim mystics, there is, particularly among Muslim mystics, I think Muslim Sufis are more aware of Christianity and Islam and Judaism than Christian mystics are aware of Islam.
So we have a spiritual retreat. We'd all be meditating, and some would be Sufis, and some would be Christians, and some would be Jews, and what difference about it? That's what you're saying.
Right, yeah. I mean, one can try and imagine that.
Right,
is monotheism enough to have in common? Sufism, I think, would emphasize the congruity, the similarities, but you know, when you get down to brass tacks, obviously there's some significant differences as well.
Yeah.
I mean, the big sticking point for Sufis and Muslims is the whole unity of God, because they look at the Trinity as being heretical in that regard. Like, how can you have three sort of pieces to God? God should be one singular thing. So that's a major sticking point.
Well, and Jesus would be a major sticking point.
Yes. Yeah, because they feel Jesus was just a prophet, that he didn't rise again. He wasn't divine. But still, I mentioned this the other session. I mean, I don't know if people are aware, like, it's just kind of a trivia thing that the Quran mentions Mary more often than the Bible does. I mean, they really do feel that they have embraced Christianity or parts of Christianity that make sense to within Islam. All right. Well, thank you for your time.
Thank you.